Okay, well, we move on now from Aristotle's doctrine of hamartia to one of the cases that he applies it to, namely Sophocles' Oedipus in Oedipus the King. And the question is whether the doctrine of hamartia applies to Oedipus, and if so, in what sense? Aristotle clearly thinks it does apply, and I argued last time that he thinks of hamartia as a moral notion, and that would suggest that Oedipus is at least to some extent to blame for his own fall, for the catastrophe that befalls him. And this is a matter that has been hotly debated for a long time. André Dacier, who was a French commentator at the end of the 17th century and wrote a commentary on Aristotle's Poetics, he certainly thought that Oedipus was to blame for his fate. And he pointed out that Oedipus is portrayed on stage as having vices of character, in particular pride, anger, foolishness, recklessness. Those vices are displayed on stage, and they are the ones, thinks Dacier, that Oedipus displayed before the stage action of the play begins, in what people call the long time of the play, that's to say in its dramatic background. The crucial events in the background of the play that bring about the tragedy are, of course, the killing by Oedipus of his father, Laius, and then Oedipus's marrying of Jocasta, his mother, Laius's widow. And the play is about his discovery, his gradual discovery of the fact that he has committed these offences. Now, as I say, the commentator Dacier thought that he was to blame for these actions and that they were grounded in his character, which is displayed on stage. But a lot of people have thought, and in fact it's probably the orthodox view, that Oedipus is not to blame for his fate. He killed his father in ignorance of who he was, and he married his mother in ignorance of who she was. He does display faults on stage. He is short-tempered. He does jump to conclusions with Tiresias and with Creon, but he's not being punished for those offences. This is a point that E.R. Dodds makes. Dodds makes much of the point that Oedipus, whatever his faults on stage, is not being punished for those faults. If he's being punished, he's being punished for the parricide and the incest. If he were being punished for the bad behaviour that he displays on stage during the action of the play, then the punishment would be completely out of proportion to the offence. There would be a complete mismatch between the relative mildness of the offence, as you might think, jumping to conclusions about the motives of Tiresias and Creon, and the appalling punishment to which he is subjected at the end of the play. So Dodds, in his article, takes a view that Oedipus is not being punished for crimes. His hamartia, if we want to talk in that way, was ignorance, so just as we saw that Hubbard translated it, and it was innocent ignorance, ignorance for which he was not responsible, so that he is morally innocent. That's Dodds's view. So that the play, whatever it's about, is not about punishment of crimes. Well, I think we can agree with Dodds that Oedipus is not being punished for the misbehaviour that he displays on stage. That would indeed be out of all proportion. But we need to ask the question, I think, why is Oedipus portrayed in the way he is? And this is something that Dodds doesn't address. And supporters of his view, people who think that Oedipus is morally innocent and that the play is perhaps a tragedy of fate or at any rate a story about how somebody can come to great suffering through no fault of his own. People who take that line have to face the question, well, why is Oedipus portrayed in the way he is on stage as somebody with the vices that we saw Dacier outline, namely recklessness, a certain violence of character, tendency to jump to conclusions, to shoot from the hip, to get angry very quickly? What was the point of portraying him in that way if the moral of the whole play is that even innocence can be fearfully punished, as it were, can suffer terribly in this life? You'd have thought that moral would be better conveyed without stressing those vices and bringing those particular vices in, because the way that I've described them and the way that Dacier describes them sort of sets things up for an answer to my question, which is that, and it seems to me that this answer is really staring one in the face, although I have to concede that it's been missed by an awful lot of critics, if that's so. It seems to me fairly obvious with Dacier that Oedipus is portrayed as having vices which are just the ones that he did display at the earlier stages when he did make mistakes. So yes, his actions on stage are not terribly culpable, not in the grand scheme of things, but we're supposed to see what they show us about his character and then make deductions about how he behaved on earlier occasions in the long time of the play, and in particular on the two crucial earlier occasions when he killed his father and married his mother, particularly the former of those, because that's described in some detail in the play by Oedipus himself. And it seems clear from his own description that his killing of Laius was a violent overreaction to a perfectly normal piece of behaviour on the part of the people he killed. And one has to sort of set this in a pre-modern context and recall that there were certain rules of the road in all pre-industrial societies and all pre-modern societies, which was that nobility of any sort on horseback or riding in a carriage, as Laius was, had precedence. And the lower orders had simply to get out of the way. Now, of course, Oedipus is technically an aristocrat. He's Laius' own son. He doesn't know that. Nobody knows that. He thinks he's the son of Polybus and Merope, the king and queen of Corinth. So he does have aristocratic status in his own eyes, and he's right about that bare fact, although wrong about exactly the nature of the status. But, of course, he's travelling incognito. He's travelling on foot as though a member of the lower orders. And as I say, it was a universally recognised rule in pre-modern societies that people travelling on foot who would normally be members of the lower orders had to get out of the way for nobility riding on horseback or in carriages. So that in the scene as it's described at the crossroads, Laius' herald, who would have been going somewhere ahead of his carriage to look out for highwaymen, he ordered Oedipus to get out of the way, and Oedipus refused. And in so doing, he put himself immediately in the wrong. He should have got out of the way, but instead he gets into a fight. He kills Laius and, as he thinks, all of the attendants. In fact, of course, crucially, one escapes. But it seems obvious from the description that Oedipus was the one who was to blame in that incident, according to the morality of the time. He should have ceded passage, and he certainly shouldn't have got violent with his betters, as to all appearances they were. So it seems to me that the implication that you get from Dacier's commentary, which is that these faults of character, a tendency to anger, to recklessness, that he displays on stage, are exactly the ones that he displayed back then when he killed his father at the crossroads. And we're supposed to reason in that way. We're supposed to think, well, that's the nature of his character. We see it now on stage in his dealings with Tiresias and with Creon. And that's how he's always been. That's how he was back in the day when he committed parricide. So Dodds is right that we're not supposed to think that he's being punished for the bad behaviour that he displays on stage. The connection is indirect. He is being punished for deeds that he committed in the past, which flowed from, as I put it in the last lecture, a character, the nature of which is revealed in his bad behaviour on stage towards Tiresias and Creon. He is portrayed by Sophocles as the sort of person who would have committed that crime of parricide in a fit of anger. And I think we are supposed to make that deduction. That is the point of the bad behaviour on stage. Otherwise, it doesn't seem to have a point. Those who say that Oedipus is morally innocent don't seem to have an answer to the question, well, why is he portrayed in this particular way? Why is he portrayed as being somebody who would have flown off the handle and killed somebody in a fit of anger, if that's not exactly what he did do? So to summarise that part of the argument, a traditionalist kind of critic of the play, so somebody who thinks that it is indeed a moral tale of sin followed by punishment, if you like to put it in religious terms, shouldn't take the implausible line that the sins for which Oedipus is being punished are committed now on stage. Rather, one should take the more sophisticated line, that the bad behaviour on stage, though in itself relatively trivial, reveals a character which in the long time of the play did issue in very serious offences, namely parricide and incest. This, incidentally, means that, first of all, it means that there are two hamartiae, there are two mistakes at least, killing his father and marrying his mother. And it also has the consequence, of course, that these occur before the play begins. And you might think that that was an objection to this view, because you would surely, I mean, Aristotle doesn't say so explicitly, but you might reasonably expect that the crucial tragic errors, the crucial tragic mistakes happen during the play. I mean, that's surely the whole point of the play, to show us these mistakes and to show us the consequences of them. And indeed, I suppose it's fair to say that in most European tragedies, that is the way things are done. The tragic errors do occur on stage. But that's not true of all of them. There are other tragedies in which the action begins at a latest point, at a point after which the crucial mistakes have been made, the crucial crimes have been committed. And the tragedy itself plays out the discovery of those crimes, if they're not known about, and the punishment of them. A classical example of that would be Aeschylus's Agamemnon, which we may discuss in due course in connection with tragic dilemmas. His hamartia is really the sacrifice of his daughter, Iphigenia, but that happens before the play begins, and the play focuses on his homecoming and the revenge exacted on him by his wife Clytemnestra. Similarly, with Oedipus, as I'm interpreting that, we don't get the whole story in this particular play. We get a later stage of it. In effect, we get the playing out of the punishment. And I think that's true of a number of other tragedies in the tradition. For example, Büchner's play Danton's Tort, Danton's Death, which is a tragedy about the French revolutionary hero Danton. Again, I think he follows the usual pattern of committing a hamartia and in effect being punished for it. But the hamartia is committed before the play begins. It's his participation in the bloodthirsty violence of the revolution, and he's now paying the price for that. It's turning on him, as it were, so that his crimes lie in the past. And the play is really exclusively about fate catching up with him. Now, although I think that Dacier was right that there's a connection between the faults of character, and in particular, as Dacier mentioned, Oedipus's recklessness, tendency to anger, and so on, and the crimes that he committed in the past, it seems to me that he hasn't put his finger on the crucial point, which is that Oedipus's real failing is a cognitive one. And again, I think we see that displayed on stage, and we are supposed to reason backwards and infer that he also exhibited these cognitive failings, or similar ones, at an earlier stage. What we see on stage is Oedipus reasoning very slowly and long after everyone else has got there to the correct conclusion that he is the guilty man, the person who is responsible for the plague at Thebes and the person who is responsible for Laius's death, and then also, as he realizes, for incest with his mother. And as I say, he realizes this sometime after Jocasta. It's not entirely clear when she realizes the truth, but it's certainly well before he does. And indeed, the shepherd who comes to give evidence, who's summoned to give evidence, realizes the truth much earlier than Oedipus. Not to mention, of course, the audience. And we get a number of indications in the play that Oedipus is not as quick on the uptake as he might be. So what is striking is that there's an almost exact match between the information that Oedipus receives quite early on in the drama about the circumstances of Laius's death and what he already knows about his own past. But he doesn't put the jigsaw pieces together in the obvious way until near the end of the play. So, for example, Jocasta tells Oedipus that Laius received an oracle that he would be killed by his son. Oedipus already knows that he received an oracle that he would kill his father. Jocasta tells Oedipus that Laius was killed at a crossroads. He already knows that he killed an older man at a crossroads. She tells him that Laius's son had his ankles fastened together. Oedipus knows that exactly that happened to him too. Oedipus hears from Creon that Laius was accompanied by a retinue, all of whom were killed except one man who escaped and reported the incident in Thebes. Well, he already knows that in the fracas with the old man, whom he killed, he also killed several others. He thought he killed all the others, but in fact, he was wrong about that. So it's not a precise match, but there's a very close match between the pieces of information that he already has and that he receives during the play from Creon and Jocasta. And it's not very difficult to put these pieces of information together in the obvious way and arrive at the correct conclusion. But instead of doing that, Oedipus reasons very poorly, and he fantasizes about possible escape routes. For example, he makes a big deal of the fact that the shepherd who got back to report the incident said that there were several robbers who had attacked the retinue, not just one. And Oedipus is very impressed by that fact and says, well, in that case, it couldn't have been me. I'm just one person, and one person can't be identical with several. And he makes a great deal of that, as it were, quasi-logical point, as though that established his innocence. Well, of course, it's quite right that one person can't be identical with several, but that merely logical point has got no weight, really, when put in the balance with the reliability of the eyewitness. There's a question as to whether he should be believing this report that the old man was killed by several people. The eyewitness, the person who escaped, may not be telling the truth, either deliberately or not deliberately. He may be deliberately lying for good political reasons. There's some motive to think that that was the case, given the way he behaves later on in the play, this shepherd. But equally, he might just have made a mistake. In the fear of the situation, he might have thought that there were more attackers than one. So Oedipus needs to reckon with the possibility that the eyewitness report is unreliable, but he doesn't do that. And another respect in which his relative obtuseness is displayed is the way in which, when he initially comes to realise that he did in fact kill Laius, the previous king of Thebes, and marry that man's wife, he leaves it at that. He doesn't immediately realise that Laius was his father and Jocasta was his mother. He realizes that he was in fact a murderer, so that the curse that he pronounces at the beginning of the play falls on him. He killed Laius, but he doesn't go further and use the information that he has from the oracle and so on to realize that in fact this was his father. So what I'm suggesting here, and other people have argued this as well, is that Oedipus exhibits cognitive failings in the play. This is, of course, against a very strong tradition, which I find surprising, but there it is, of commentators who say that he's displayed as a sort of master detective, as somebody of supreme intelligence, reasoning his way, like some Sherlock Holmes, to the conclusion which nobody else can see until he's seen it. And of course, it seems to be obvious that the reverse is the truth. As I said before, everyone sees the truth except Oedipus long before he gets there. And what we see displayed on stage is not acuity and intellectual brilliance, but the opposite. And again, I think the same point applies as before. The point, if we ask, well, what is the point of showing Oedipus being so slow on the uptake? Well, we're supposed to deduce that that is part of his nature. We're supposed to deduce things about his character from this and then infer backwards to the earlier crimes that he committed, the parricide and the incest, and say, well, he should have displayed cognitive abilities there, which he didn't display. He should have worked out at an earlier stage the truth of the matter. In other words, you know, I mean, and this is made fairly blunt in the play, because he kills his father at the crossroads not long after he has received the oracle from Apollo, whom he went to consult, telling him that he would kill his father. And, as I say, not long after that, in short order, he kills an older man. Now, he thinks that his father is Polybus back in Corinth, so he thinks this older man that he meets at the crossroads couldn't possibly be his father, but he needed to reckon with a slightly wider range of possibilities than he does. That takes us to the oracle that he receives from Apollo, and that is, of course, the third indication he receives that he's not who he thinks he is. The first is the fact that a drunkard accused him at a feast of not being his parents' child, not being the son of Polybus and Merope. Well, that's not a terribly strong piece of evidence, perhaps, or at least it's of doubtful value. It might. Sometimes people do come out with the truth when they're drunk, but sometimes they don't. So not much can be placed on that. But Oedipus then goes and asks his parents a direct question, namely, are you my parents? And they don't give him a straight answer. They just get angry about the drunkard's words. And that is a fairly good piece of circumstantial evidence that something is not quite right. He then goes and consults the oracle of Apollo at Delphi, and again, Apollo does not give him a straight answer to a straight question, but instead predicts to him that he will kill his father and marry his mother. Now, an intelligent person, I think, would put these pieces of evidence together and infer that in all likelihood, Polybus and Merope are not his real parents, or at least that's a distinct possibility, and would undertake not to kill an older man or marry an older woman, not marry a woman old enough to be his mother. That's what a sensible person would do in the situation in which Oedipus is placed. But he doesn't do that. Not long after, he's killed an older man and married a woman old enough to be his mother. So I think we're supposed to think that his tendency to precipitate action without thinking things through, which we see displayed on stage, and his shortness of temper, his tendency to anger, these things all conspired, if you like, at an earlier stage to produce the mistakes that he made, which were essentially cognitive mistakes, essentially failures of reasoning. And I'm putting that in such a way as to take issue with another fairly standard interpretation of the play. I mean, one standard interpretation, as I've just indicated a moment ago, is that Oedipus is displayed as a supreme intellectual who is nevertheless brought down, highly intelligent person whose intellectual skills do not avail to save him, he is nevertheless brought down, despite his great abilities. And this is supposed to accentuate the tragedy. And it's also supposed to be, and this is the second point, that a kind of attack on Enlightenment values. A lot of people interpret the play, you'll see this very commonly, as an attack on Enlightenment values, an attack on rationality. So that the idea is, you know, human beings preen themselves on their powers of reason, on their rationality. And look, here's Oedipus, a top specimen of the species, if you like, a supremely rational man. And yet, in spite of that, rationality avails nothing against these malign forces that are at work in the play, which bring down Oedipus, which can bring anyone down. So that Enlightenment values, as it were, go for nothing. So it's as if Sophocles is mocking the power of reason. And as I said, that's a very standard interpretation of the play, but it seems to me, and as you'll gather from the way I've been talking about it so far, that it's the absolute reverse of the truth. The play does not challenge Enlightenment values. It precisely upholds them, because what it displays is a failure of rationality and the catastrophe that that leads to. Oedipus should have reasoned in such a way that he didn't commit the crimes that he did. And a failure of rationality in the play itself. That's the same point as before, namely that he's not being punished for his failure of rationality displayed on stage, but we're supposed to deduce from that that he has cognitive flaws and that these were exemplified in the long time of the play at the earlier stage when he committed the crucial crimes. Now, we need to introduce another aspect which has been crucial to discussions about the Oedipus, namely the question to what extent Oedipus is free, is a free agent, because that's obviously important. If one's saying, as I am, that he is punished for crimes committed in the long time of the play, and that he was indeed responsible for those crimes, so that the punishment is in some sense deserved, then one needs to assure oneself that he acted freely and not under compulsion. And a lot of people have thought that he is not responsible for his deeds, that the gods are responsible, in particular Apollo. And that view is expressed at one point by Tiresias, that Apollo is, as it were, behind everything, by Oedipus himself at one point towards the end of the play. And of course we have the fact that Apollo makes the prediction that Oedipus will kill his father and marry his mother. And he made the earlier prediction to Laius himself that if he had a child, he would be killed by that child. And one might think that all of this pointed to Apollo's responsibility, so that Apollo, the gods in general, are to blame for Oedipus's fate, not Oedipus himself. However, it seems to me there's really very little indication in the play that Apollo forces Oedipus. Apollo certainly makes a prediction, but that's quite different from bringing about a state of affairs. I mean, it's an interesting form of prediction, if you like, because it is revealed to Oedipus himself. And part of the effect of revealing that prediction is that, indeed, the events will come about. It's precisely because Oedipus hears the prediction from Apollo's oracle at Delphi that he decides not to go back to Corinth, where he would have been safe, in fact, but takes to the open road, and there he meets his father, and so on and so forth. So that the prediction itself is a causal factor in its being brought about. It feeds into the causal chain, the fact that the prediction is made to Oedipus himself, that he knows of the prediction. However, that, of course, does not in itself absolve him from responsibility. That doesn't detract from his freedom. I'll give you another example of that, since we'll be talking about Macbeth later on. In one of the sources for Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth, there's a story about a king, Natholicus, who sends one of his servants, a trusted gentleman, to consult a witch about a rebellion which he thinks is being fermented against him. So the gentleman goes and consults the witch, and the witch tells the gentleman that Natholicus will be killed by a close and trustworthy friend, murdered by a trustworthy friend, in fact, by that very gentleman himself. Now, he is amazed to hear this prediction and furious, and he reviles the witch for her villainous prophecy. The thought of killing the king has never occurred to him, and he's a loyal servant of the king, so what a ridiculous prophecy is his first reaction, and offensive. But as he travels back from consulting the witch to the king's castle, he thinks, well, if I tell the king what the witch said, or if I refuse to tell him, which is a bit suspicious, and he finds out in some other way, somebody else tells him, my life will be in danger, because the king will then have reason to put me out of the way. He will have reason to fear me, even though he knows I've been trustworthy up till now. If a witch prophesies that I'm going to murder him, the king's going to naturally get a bit jumpy about that. And so that will give him a reason to exile, if not kill me. So the gentleman thinks I'd better strike first. And when he gets back to court, he kills the king. So you see, you have again the same kind of scenario, that the witch issues a prophecy to the gentleman, and the very fact that she tells him of her prophecy is a major causal factor in bringing it about, in bringing about its truth. If he hadn't heard it, if she hadn't made that prophecy, or if she'd made it but just to herself, if she hadn't communicated it to him, then he wouldn't have killed the king, so the prophecy would have been false. Is in part because she communicates it to the gentleman that she ensures its truth. But, and this is a crucial point here, at no point in that story is the gentleman not free. He is free at every stage to do what he wants. It's his decision to kill the king when he gets back to court. He's not under any kind of duress or constraint to do that. So I think a similar situation applies in the case of the Oedipus. I think the parallel is quite close. The prediction is made to Oedipus. He doesn't engage in the sort of ratiocination that the gentleman does, and indeed that's part of his problem, as I've been saying, his cognitive defects. But it's in part because the prediction is made to him that he acts in such a way as to fulfil it. But at every stage, he's a free agent. At every stage, he acts freely. He freely decides to consult the oracle at Delphi. He freely decides not to go back to Corinth, but to take to the open road. And he gets involved in this fracas with the older aristocrat. And he acts freely in that situation as well, as the description of it makes clear. And he freely accepts the hand of Jocasta when he arrives at Thebes. When he arrives at Thebes, as I perhaps should have mentioned in an earlier stage, of course, he solves the Sphinx's riddle, he rescues Thebes from that curse, and as a reward he's given the hand of Jocasta in marriage, and he freely accepts it. So it seems to me that at every stage Oedipus acts freely. He's described, depicted as acting freely, and I don't see any reason not to trust that surface description, as it were. I think we'd need more indication that the causation is not as it appears. If we were really supposed to think, well, of course, Apollo is making all of this happen. The mere fact that Tiresias says that is not an indication that it's true, because he expresses it, and one thing, he expresses it in fairly vague terms. And for another thing, he is only one agent in the play. He has admittedly a special status, but he says it at a point where he and Oedipus are already getting into a wrangle. So we can't necessarily take that as sort of gospel, the fact that Tiresias says Apollo will bring these things about, and mean that in a causally very heavy way. Now, I've been reasoning about this in what philosophers would call a compatibilist way. That's to say, I'm treating freedom as, in the way that Hume did really, as a matter of acting in the absence of constraint, where constraint is something that is typically supplied by other human beings. Or it could be forces of nature, but it's large-scale surface phenomena that operate to constrain you. We're not talking about the microbiology of your brain. That simply doesn't matter to freedom, according to the compatibilist view. Freedom involves doing what you want to do, where you're not subject to any kind of overt constraint. And a modern compatibilist takes a slightly more subtle position than Hume did, because we recognise forms of constraint, such as brainwashing, that Hume didn't think about. So we would allow that somebody who's been brainwashed and goes out and commits a crime, and maybe wants to, is very happy to commit this crime, nevertheless does so as a result of the brainwashing, we allow that that person is in some sense not free. Similarly, we allow that people who are subject to certain pathologies, certain obsessions, are not free. So a kleptomaniac, for example, might be perfectly happy stealing things. That person is doing what he or she wants to do. But in many situations, we wouldn't consider that person free because they're subject to an irrational pathology. This is something that Hume himself didn't particularly take into account. But modern compatibilists like Susan Wolfe, for example, in her book Freedom Within Reason, which I always recommend to students, I think it's an excellent study of compatibilism, that's the kind of thing that a modern compatibilist would take into account. And I think that the ancients in general thought about freedom in a compatibilist way. That's to say, they weren't particularly bothered about the microphysical causation of actions. They were bothered about the obvious and large-scale causes of action. And if those were in the control of the person acting, if that person was not being subjected to duress or force of any sort by another person or by some kind of very obvious force of nature, such as a storm, then that person would count as free. So I've been presupposing that kind of compatibilist view in thinking of Oedipus as free. But I think the position can be made even stronger than that, because I think even if you do think that Apollo does determine the main events of the drama, and in particular the acts of parricide and incest, even if you think that Sophocles represents Apollo as literally determining those acts, that would still not detract from Oedipus's freedom. And that is because of a very important principle, I think, governing all divine intervention in traditional literature, really, epic and drama, which is that when gods intervene, they do so, when they intervene, as it were, to make, in inverted commas, somebody do something, or to advise somebody to do something, the intervention can be more or less heavy-handed. But when they do intervene in that way, they always intervene in accordance with the person's character. This is a point that Aquinas pointed out. Aquinas said the god, I mean, he was thinking of the Christian god, but I think the point applies to the pagan gods as well. The god acts in each person according to that person's character. When you do something under divine influence, you do what you might or would have done anyway, given the character that you have. So that divine intervention, to put it in a slightly more technical way, in traditional literature, is, I think, epiphenomenal. It doesn't play a functional role in bringing about things that would not otherwise have happened. It's a way of casting, of ennobling, of raising to a higher level human action. It's not a displacement of human responsibility. And you see this in traditional literature in various ways. I mean, one is that individuals who are, as it were, made to do things by gods, who either claim that they've been made to do things by gods, or who the poet describes as being made to do something by God, these individuals always take responsibility for their actions. Oedipus does in our very play towards the end, where he says, "None but I did what I did." In the Iliad, when Agamemnon apologizes to Achilles, when they resolve the dispute between them, on which the whole poem turns, and Achilles is then able to rejoin the Greek army after his long sulk, Agamemnon makes amends and apologizes. He blames the gods for his madness, as it were. He says, well, he claims that he himself wasn't responsible, but it was the gods that led him astray. But he nevertheless goes ahead and makes amends and in effect apologizes, as though he were responsible. And the obvious way to read that, I think, is to think, well, this is just rhetoric, really. I mean, this is a way of trying to save face, in a way, to say, well, I was struck by madness by the gods. But the fact that he really thinks he was responsible is shown by his actions. And I think the same applies to the Oedipus, and that is how Oedipus himself sees it. Another example would be the witches in Macbeth. The witches don't make Macbeth kill Duncan with their prophecies. They don't in any sense force him to do what he does. I mentioned a moment ago the Natholicus story on which Macbeth is partly based, which is quite similar to the Oedipus one. And of course, in Macbeth itself, we have the witches prophesying to Macbeth, and their prophecy comes true, and it's partly because he hears it that it does come true. So again, it's another of these cases of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But again, it's a case where the witches don't make Macbeth do it. They don't take away his freedom. And they are, in a sense, a representation of his own motives and desires. And the key moment which shows that is the moment when Macbeth starts, as he hears their prophecy. Banquo points this out. Macbeth starts when he hears their prophecy. And the reason why he does that is because it speaks to him in a very deep way. It answers to thoughts that he has already had. So that, again, we have an application of Aquinas's dictum. The witches are, in some sense, an embodiment of motives and desires that he already has. And they are a way of representing those motives and desires. They're not an independent external agent which we are to think of as intervening in the causation of the plot, as though they were like human agents putting their own causal input into it. No, they work at a completely different level, and this is true of gods generally in traditional literature. They're not like human agents. They don't have their own separate causal input. They are a level of representation of the causation that goes on at the human level, which is sufficient for everything. There's no derogation from human freedom, and to the extent that gods intervene, they do so in accordance with the characters and the intentions and the motives that human agents themselves already in any way have. As A.C. Bradley put it about Macbeth, "Macbeth did not murder Duncan because he saw a dagger in the air. He saw the dagger because he was about to murder Duncan." And that seems to me exactly right, and sort of encapsulates in a nutshell the way the supernatural functions in tragedy and traditional literature generally as an ennobling, a way of representing at a higher level what's going on the human plane, but not a way of undermining the autonomy and sufficiency of the human plane, not a way of undermining human freedom. So the old dictum that character is fate seems to me correct. Who you are, what sort of character you have, that will be responsible for your fate. Your actions will flow from your character. And it's because you have the character that you do that you have the fate that you do. That seems to me how responsibility is portrayed in tragedy. There is that kind of Aristotelian connection of intelligibility and comprehensibility between an agent's character and the things that befall him or her.